Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, bringing you news from the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff. And this is news from the Saturday, February 14th edition. So happy Valentine's Day. I'm volunteer reader Joe, and welcome aboard. And let's get started with front page headline news. First up there, we have an article written by Sun staff reporter Sam McLaughlin, titled, Police Court Records Paint Tragic But Familiar Picture of Hazing Death at NAU Fraternity. Statements of probable cause filed with the Flagstaff Justice Court and a copy of the Flagstaff Police Department's initial report offer some details on the circumstances surrounding a January 31st hazing-related death at Northern Arizona University's Delta Tau Delta Fraternity. The police report obtained by the Arizona Daily Sun is heavily redacted and includes only officers' preliminary reports from the scene and not detectives' follow-ups. Still, both documents reveal the victim was pressured to drink large quantities of alcohol and rapidly deteriorated into a nonverbal state that prompted concern, but no immediate action to seek help from others in attendance. Note, out of respect for the victim's family, the Daily Sun is not disclosing his name at this time. David Bianchi, a Florida-based attorney who specializes in fraternity hazing deaths, told the Daily Sun that the basic facts of the case fit a familiar and heartbreaking pattern. I've had far too many cases with almost the exact same scenario as you're describing here, Bianchi said. Overconsumption of alcohol. The statements of probable cause allege the fraternity hosted a party at 12 South Pine Grove Road as the conclusion of its 2026 Spring Rush week of events. Per the fraternity's social media, the events included a house tour, a casino night, a values night, interviews with prospective members, and a final invitation-only dinner on the evening of January 30th. The total number of people at the event was reportedly between 20 and 30 at its peak. The 18-year-old victim was one of the four pledges invited to the dinner and invited to join the fraternity. Another pledge told police the four were warned they would be intoxicated and instructed to bring anything they would need for the evening to the fraternity house. By this account, the pledges were driven around with pillowcases over their heads, then told to stand outside the fraternity house for half an hour without speaking. They were instructed to participate in a drinking game known as Don't F Your Brother, in which each person drinks from a bottle of alcohol before passing it on, and the bottle must be finished by the last person in the line or circle. The four pledges were given a handle, or 1.75 liters, of vodka to consume collectively. Police noted that there were conflicting witness reports about whether the bottle actually contained only vodka or whether the liquor had been watered down with water. The victim drank first and reportedly consumed at least one-third of the bottle's contents, the rough equivalent of a dozen or more shots. The pledges were encouraged or forced to vomit during a 30-minute break, police reported. Following that break, the four repeated the game. This time, the victim supposedly drank nearly two-thirds of a second handle of vodka. Allegedly, participation in these drinking games was a requirement for pledges to join the fraternity. Witnesses told police that older members of the fraternity helped buy alcohol for younger members, and that some younger members of the organization possessed fake IDs. Carter Eslick, the fraternity's new member educator, allegedly admitted to police that he had provided the alcohol to the pledges as part of their initiation. The pledges' alcohol consumption began around 9 p.m. The statements of probable cause do not mention whether the victims drank additional alcohol outside of these games. Other alcohol was certainly available. The inside and outside of the residence was littered with empty beer cans, one officer stated. Another observed a large amount of empty alcohol bottles in the dining/living room area, including both liquor and beer bottles, as well as an odor of fresh burnt marijuana. Not long after the beginning of the drinking games, between 10 and 11 p.m., though the exact time is unclear, the victim was reportedly nonverbal, unable to stand on his own, and had been helped to lie down on an air mattress. The statement of probable cause suggests that at least some attendees at the party were concerned about the victim's condition. One person reported that shortly after midnight, the victim had an unusual snore breath and started gagging as well. Others began to Google symptoms of alcohol poisoning around 3 a.m. Attendees reportedly adjusted the victim's sleeping position and checked his pulse. Ryan Creech, the fraternity's vice president, reported checking to see if the victim was breathing at 5:30 a.m. Riley Cass, fraternity treasurer, allegedly remained by the victim's side until around 6 a.m., at which point he went to retrieve a jacket and fell asleep elsewhere. At 8:44 a.m., the victim was discovered to be lying on his back, unresponsive and cold to the touch. Although one witness said people were panicking following the discovery, Creech called 911 and someone began CPR. Police officers arriving on the scene observed a dark, possibly bloody, fluid spilling from the victim's mouth with each chest compression. The officers assisted with CPR until personnel from Guardian Medical Transport took over, but the victim was pronounced dead at the scene. Police noted that all of the individuals who were present at the house were distraught or visibly upset. A representative of Victim Witness Services was asked to come to the scene. Creech initially told a police officer that the party had nothing to do with pledging for the fraternity, contrary to other accounts. Per the police report, he claimed this was a typically Friday night for the house. Officers transported seven individuals to police headquarters for additional questioning. Of those seven, only three were arrested: Cass, Creech, and Eslick. All three were accused of hazing contributing to an individual's death, a Class 4 felony. In addition to the three members of the fraternity board who were arrested, Delta Tau Delta President Cameron Musso was allegedly also present during the event. Musso was not arrested and has not been charged with any criminal offenses. Cass, Creech, and Eslick were all released on their own recognizance, that is, with a promise to appear for all future court proceedings, on the afternoon of February 1st, the day after their arrest. As of February 13th, no formal criminal complaints had yet been filed with the Justice Court by the Coconino County Attorney's Office. Legal structure exists, but not always utilized. Bianchi, the anti-hazing attorney, said the circumstances of the victim's death were tragically familiar. What typically happens is, in all of the cases I've had that are almost identical to this one, these pledges get drunk, they can't walk, they can't talk, so they are then laid down someplace in the fraternity house, either on the floor, on a couch, on a bed, to quote-unquote sleep it off, he explained. Then people stop really paying attention, and at some point, late at night, they vomit and they aspirate their own vomit. The victim's cause of death has not been officially confirmed in this case. However, aspiration of vomit leading to asphyxiation is a frequent cause of death in cases of alcohol poisoning. Alcohol intoxication can also depress a person's respiratory drive, which can sometimes be fatal on its own. It is absolutely heartbreaking to think that this factual pattern repeats itself over and over again, despite the efforts of so many people nationally to try to stop it, Bianchi said. Hundreds of individuals have died from hazing in the past 25 years, despite legislative and administrative attempts to rein in the problem. Almost every state in the United States has an anti-hazing law, he continued. Every major fraternity in the country has an anti-hazing policy, and every significant college and university has an anti-hazing policy. So all the laws, rules, and regulations needed to try to stop this behavior are already on the books. Enforcement of those laws or policies, however, is not uniform. Whether fraternity members face criminal charges, for instance, is largely dependent on the prosecutor, Bianchi said. He cited one fatal hazing case at Florida State University in which 9 fraternity members were charged and pleaded guilty, but also another case at Cornell University where no charges were ever filed. If you do not aggressively enforce the criminal statutes that make hazing a crime, then you're not going to stop fraternity members from doing it again, because they're not going to really fear the consequences, Bianchi said. In a statement that night, Northern Arizona University said, "We want to be clear. The safety and well-being of our students remain our highest priorities. Violence, hazing, or any other behavior that endangers others has no place at NAU." Although 3 fraternity members were arrested in this case, Bianchi believes the web of responsibility and of liability extends much further. "I can guarantee you that there are more than 3 people that could be facing criminal charges in the case we're talking about," he said, "because there were more than 3 people involved in planning this event, in buying the alcohol, in serving the alcohol, and in planning for the actual hazing that took place." In addition to criminal prosecutions, Bianchi believes NAU should also act swiftly against the fraternity and its members. "Once the university has evidence that there was an illegal hazing event involving alcohol that was illegally served to people who are underage, the university should be immediately expelling everyone involved. And they rarely do that," Bianchi said. "Internal disciplinary processes can drag on ineffectually for years," he noted. "I have seen cases where fraternity members responsible for hazing where someone has died graduated from the university before the disciplinary process was even completed." Bianchi has represented the families of hazing victims in civil litigation against fraternities. "I've made a recovery for every single family," he said. "But those settlements, the precise details of which remain confidential, are no replacement for a lost child." Arizona's anti-hazing law includes a provision similar to other laws Bianchi has helped draft and pass, providing protection from criminal prosecution in hazing incidents for someone who calls 911, cooperates with law enforcement, and remains with the victim until emergency personnel arrive. "The goal of such laws," Bianchi said, "is to save lives by removing the fear of legal consequences that fraternity members or bystanders might have. Ask any parent who has lost their son to hazing, and they will all tell you the same thing. They would much rather have their son back than prosecute the person who did it," he added. The limited Good Samaritan provision of Arizona's law likely could have applied in this scenario, sparing at least the person who asked for help for the victim from criminal consequences. But nobody at the Delta Tau Delta residence contacted emergency services until it was already too late. In this particular case, if someone in the fraternity house who saw this victim laying there so drunk that he could not move, if someone had called 911, there's a very good chance that he would be alive today, Bianchi said. And that was "Police Court Records Paint Tragic but Familiar Picture of Hazing Death at NAU Fraternity." Continuing with front page headline news, our next article is also by Sam McLaughlin and is titled, "Suspect in Flagstaff Shootout and Fatal Helicopter Crash Faces 60 Criminal Charges." The man who allegedly engaged in a prolonged exchange of gunfire with Flagstaff Police Department officers the night of February 4th has been charged with 60 criminal offenses in Coconino County Superior Court, including charges of murder for the deaths of two Arizona Department of Public Safety personnel whose helicopter crashed during the incident. Terrell Story, 50, was arrested February 4th and booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility the following day after receiving treatment at Flagstaff Medical Center for a gunshot wound. He remains in jail with his bond set at $5 million, cash only. A criminal complaint against Story, filed in Flagstaff Justice Court on Monday, February 9th, included 49 felony charges and one misdemeanor. But the supervening grand jury indictment, approved on Thursday, February 12th, and announced by the Coconino County Attorney's Office on Friday morning, added another 10 felony charges to that list. The indictment includes two counts of first-degree murder committed in the course of burglary, 28 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, including 27 counts of aggravated assault against a law enforcement officer, 6 counts of first-degree residential burglary, 6 counts of endangerment creating a substantial risk of imminent death, 11 counts of disorderly conduct with a deadly weapon, 2 counts of possession of a firearm by a prohibited person, 2 counts of discharging a firearm at a residential structure, 1 count of resisting arrest, 1 count of unlawfully discharging a firearm within city limits, and 1 count of disorderly conduct by engaging in fighting, violence, or disruptive behavior. The majority of those charges are also alleged to be dangerous offenses under Arizona law because they involve the discharge, use, or threatening exhibition of a semi-automatic rifle. Dangerous offense is a legal designation that increases the potential sentences Story could face if convicted of those charges. Additionally, one count of aggravated assault and the one misdemeanor count of disorderly conduct are alleged to be domestic violence offenses committed against Story's wife. The path to the murder charges is slightly complex. Under Arizona law, a person can be charged with first-degree murder if, while committing or attempting to commit certain specified other crimes, they cause the death of another person. One of those specified crimes is burglary. As defined in Arizona law, the crime of burglary does not require theft, only entering or remaining unlawfully in or on a residential structure with the intent to commit any theft or any felony. By climbing onto his neighbor's roof without permission and with the intent to fire upon police, Story allegedly committed the offense of burglary, thus opening up the possibility of holding him criminally liable for the deaths that occurred during the incident. However, to obtain a conviction for murder, prosecutors would have to prove to a jury that Story caused the deaths of the two DPS personnel. The strength of that argument could depend on the conclusions of the ongoing investigation into the helicopter crash. The National Transportation Safety Board and the Arizona Department of Public Safety have not yet released any information from that investigation. Deputy County Attorney Jonathan Mosher, who typically leads homicide prosecutions for the Coconino County Attorney's Office, signed the Justice Court complaint and the Superior Court indictment. The Coconino County Public Defender's Office has been appointed to represent Story in court proceedings. The specific allegations against Story are subject to change as the case progresses. Prosecutors may add, drop, or modify charges as additional evidence is considered. Our hearts remain with the families of Hunter Bennett and Robert Skanky, and with all the families impacted by this incident, County Attorney Ammon Barker stated in a press release. We are committed to pursuing this case with the diligence and care it requires. The county attorney's office is ethically prohibited from commenting on the evidence in an active prosecution or discussing facts beyond those contained in the public charging documents. Alcohol argument preceded shootout. Although many details of the evening's events remain unknown at this time, the statement of probable cause filed with the Justice Court alleges Story was drinking heavily prior to the incident. His wife later told detectives Story was verbally abusive and behaving erratically. His anger reportedly escalated when she called the police. The statement also notes that Story was reported shooting from the rooftops of residential structures and/or from the fenced yards of residences. The statement and the criminal complaint lists four properties besides Story's own residence from which he allegedly fired shots. Story consistently ignored commands to surrender, reloaded his rifle, and repeatedly fired shots at officers attempting to arrest him over a period of approximately 2 hours, according to the court filings. He was shocked with a taser and also shot in the leg before being arrested. Terrell confirmed his wife called the police and that he fired a rifle. The statement of probable cause concludes, officers and witnesses observed Terrell produce a rifle and fire from it at officers. Multiple casings were found over a large scene. As of Friday morning, the date of Story's formal arraignment in Superior Court had not yet been confirmed. And that was suspect in Flagstaff shootout and fatal helicopter crash faces 60 criminal charges. Looks like Sam McLaughlin has been busy these days because he also wrote our next headline article. This is Nonprofit Forced to Shift Gears. Flyers, which is abbreviated FLYRS, rolls past fundraising platforms collapse in the second decade. Joining a list of creditors hoping to recover funds from a bankrupt fundraising platform was not part of the 10-year anniversary plan for Flagstaff Youth Riders. And again, that's abbreviated FLYRS, and I'll call it Flyers. Since its founding in 2016, Flyers has welcomed thousands of kids from ages 2 to 18 to its mountain bike summer camps, school programs, riding groups, and race teams. The organization's goal is to lower the sport's barrier to entry and make mountain biking accessible to as many local youths as possible. Over those 10 years, the nonprofit grew steadily, relying on a mix of program fees, donations, and sponsorships. But late last year, the collapse of the California-based fundraising platform FlipCause threw a stick into the group's spokes. FlipCause was our website host. It was our registration system, and it was our donor management system, Flyers Executive Director Quinn Travis explained. The platform offered an all-encompassing one-stop shop for nonprofits like us, he said, particularly smaller organizations with limited budgets for information technology. Thousands of such nonprofits across the United States relied on FlipCause, but in the fall of 2025, many of them began to report delayed or withheld payments from the company. In November, the California Attorney General ordered FlipCause to cease operations. And on December 9th, the company declared bankruptcy. Bankruptcy filings revealed that FlipCause owes a staggering $29 million in total to more than 3,000 organizations. And as reported by Oakland Voices, a community journalism program in the city where FlipCause was headquartered, the company paid more than $3.8 million to executives, family members, and a web of related entities during the same period when nonprofits were reporting delays in receiving funds. Flyers is one of the non-priority creditors listed in the FlipCause bankruptcy petition. According to that court filing, FlipCause owes Flyers $51,389. Travis explained that those funds came from registration fees paid by parents of Flyers riders. "We rely heavily on those program fees. That's really our only source of income that's transactional," he said. The fees make up about a sixth of Flyers' annual revenue and help to pay coaches, provide bikes and helmets, and support fee-free school programs. The loss is not a fatal blow for Flyers. Travis said he's grateful that the organization had enough funding available to sustain it until spring registration brings a new influx of program fees. That isn't the case for all of the other small community-oriented service organizations impacted by the Flip Cause bankruptcy, he noted. A lot of nonprofits are shutting the doors. "It's a tough situation, but Flyers is looking for the silver lining and looking ahead to the future, too. We take it on the chin and we're moving forward," Travis said. Opportunity for evolution. Flyers had been using Flip Cause since at least 2019, Travis said, following the lead of a larger youth cycling organization in another state that has often served as a model for their work. "Even before the bankruptcy, there were signs that something might be amiss. Following spring registration in 2025, funds were supposed to be deposited to Flyers' account in 7 to 10 business days. Day 14, day 20, day 26, now 30 days, and we finally got the funds, but it was concerning," Travis recalled. "The same delay happened after summer registration. At that point, the Flyers team decided the fall registration would be its last on the platform. We had plans to walk away from Flip Cause," Travis said. "Unfortunately, those plans weren't as fast as the company's demise. Travis is still hoping that at least some of the money owed to Flyers might materialize. Hopefully, we don't just get like 10 bucks at the end of the day," he said. "Hopefully, we can get at least a few thousand dollars back." But he knows the organization will most likely never receive what it's owed. "There was no choice but to move forward," he added. "That meant building a completely new website and setting up a new registration program for Flyers programs. Though challenging, Travis also found the process to be motivating, as it provided an opportunity to refresh the organization's online presence and rethink and revamp some of the other digital elements of operations, such as introductory training videos for coaches and social media. If anything, we've evolved," he said. "Most importantly," Travis said, "Flyers will continue to do what it's always done, without asking more from the families of young riders. We haven't increased prices because of this. Our biggest mission is to remove the barriers to the sport by keeping entry-level costs affordable to most families," he said. "As a nonprofit, that's our work," he continued. "That's what we strive for, is to get kids who don't have a bike but love riding bikes. We want to get those kids in our free programs and provide a bike for them and a helmet. To support that mission and to help Flyers continue to grow throughout the next decade of its operations, the group has soft launched a 10th anniversary fundraising campaign with a $100,000 goal. In part, that funding will help the organization move past its losses to Flip Cause, but Travis stressed that it's also an effort to create longer-term stability and new opportunities. "This 10-year campaign is to celebrate Flyers and 10 years of access that we've given to the sport of mountain biking here in Flagstaff, and to honor and celebrate the next decade of Flyers," he said. "We're on our feet, but hopefully it'll get us running again," he added. Travis hopes to see Flyers continue along a path of incremental and sustainable growth. "In the short term, this year we'll see an expansion of the school programs to include Cromer Elementary School in Doney Park, something Travis said has been one of his priorities since coming aboard. In the longer term, he's eyeing up the possibility of hosting clinics for parents who want to learn to ride with their children, adding more community events like last year's movie night and Halloween ride, and someday moving the organization's offices to a less cramped space. We've got shelving and boxes, we've got water bottles stacked to the ceiling and bikes just everywhere, he said, laughing. And Travis, who told the Arizona Daily Sun in 2024 that he was excited to see his daughter join the push bike program, is ready to shift into even higher gears. I want my daughter to be a coach one day, he said. I want to see my grandkids in Flyers. That's my goal. I want to see it last for a long time. More information about Flyers programs and how to support the organization is available at flyrsaz.com. And that article was titled Nonprofit Forced to Shift Gears. And we're about halfway through the broadcast, so this is a good time to remind you that you're listening to news from the Arizona Daily Sun, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. You can listen to our live streams and learn more about how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. Okay, that brings us to our final front page headline story written by Sun Staff reporter Abigail Kessler. This is FHS recognized for FAFSA completion rates. School counselors set goal of increasing number. Flagstaff High School, abbreviated FHS, was among a group of high schools across the state recognized for improving FAFSA completion rates this fall as part of a campaign from the Arizona Board of Regents, or ABOR. The school's guidance counselors are continuing their work this semester with a goal of reaching 75% FAFSA completion among the senior class by April 30th. A total of 73 schools were recognized for either reaching 50% FAFSA completion among their senior class by the end of 2025, or for increasing their completion rates by at least 10% from the prior year. FHS was the only school from Coconino County on either list. The school will be receiving a $2,000 incentive from ABOR's 50 by Fall campaign in recognition of its raising FAFSA completion rates by 10% from the previous year. FHS's guidance counselors, including Kate Jaffe, Chris Pabst, and Jennifer Bland, have been working one-on-one with students and bringing in local experts to lead workshops and class sessions throughout the fall. They also work with school parents, answering questions and hosting a financial aid night. The school had a 48% completion rate among its seniors at the end of 2025 and was nearing 55% in early February. Jaffe described the school's approach as using tiers of support for the students. It starts with group lessons and presentations in the classrooms. Those who need extra help can then take part in a small group with a visiting mentor from Northern Arizona University's Northern Arizona College Resource Center, abbreviated NACRC, or an individual session with either a school counselor or one of the visiting experts. I think if you have any inkling of wanting to go to anything post-secondary, whether it's a trade school, community college, four-year university, I've even heard the military likes to have a FAFSA on file, Jaffe said, in regards to which high school seniors should be filling out a FAFSA. And I'm just going to interject here because it seems like the author here is never going to tell us what FAFSA is. It stands for Financial or Free Application for Federal Student Aid. Okay, moving on. She added, if you're thinking post-secondary, I think it's really good because you never know where you're going to be right before you walk across the stage. Even if you think you don't want to go do anything, you could change your mind the next day. You want to have every opportunity to make that happen, and having that FAFSA on file can really help open up doors for kids. The counselors get completion data for their school on a weekly basis, and use that to identify students who might need additional assistance. They compare those reports to information they get from colleges about which students have applied and talk to students about the opportunities FAFSA completion might make available to them. We're able to narrow down which students might still need some support, and we don't have to wait a long period of time before we're able to reach back out to those students, Pabst said. The counselors said students and their family members will also come to them with questions about the process. They sometimes direct specific questions to the Ask Benji chatbot created by Education Forward Arizona, which can answer FAFSA questions online 24/7. During the fall semester, FHS hosted workshops during the school day for its seniors, and college students from NACRC visited the school once a week to troubleshoot FAFSA applications with seniors. Danielle Bonfig, who works for NAU's Economic Policy Institute, gave presentations about the FAFSA's importance to government and economics classes at the school, and Coconino Community College sent people from its financial aid department to answer student questions. FHS's guidance counselors also work with students and their families, answering questions as they come in. During the spring semester, they plan to offer additional workshops and open office hours during the half-day scheduled for parent-teacher conferences. Bland, Jaffe, and Pabst described FHS's FAFSA efforts as a school-wide campaign that is ongoing from previous years. The school counselors are available to help with any questions that parents or students may have, and we are happy to help and get them set for their next adventure after high school, Bland said. Jaffe added that having opportunities to work on FAFSA during the school day helps students find the time in their schedules, thanking school administrators for their support. We know some kids don't have access to internet, or they're working, or they're taking care of siblings, or they're away at sports all hours of the night, she said. Allowing them time during the school day to have a moment to sit and think about what their post-secondary plans are and what their steps are, that's important. Doing it is so helpful to helping them actually check those things off their list to reach their goals and having people here who can help them through it. FHS plans to use the ABOR incentive to recognize students who already completed their FAFSA and encourage others to do so. One idea was to purchase gift cards for students who complete the FAFSA or to throw a party for them. The FAFSA is an important resource for many of our students to help them obtain their post-secondary goals, Jaffe said in a presentation to FUSD's board in late January. Not only does it provide access to federal and state aid, but many colleges use FAFSA info to award their own institutional grants and scholarships. She noted that these funds help students pay for costs such as housing, books, and laptops, as well as their college tuition. According to the College Ready Arizona site, students completing the FAFSA are 84% more likely to enroll in some type of post-secondary education directly after high school. A session with a counselor to fill out the application might look like helping the student with the different steps and telling them which documents they're going to need to ask their parents for information from. It's a really intense document if students haven't had to fill it out before, Pab said. Bland advised families wanting to help their students with the FAFSA to schedule a time to sit down with them and complete it. It takes around 25 minutes to complete, she said, and includes portions for both the student and their guardian. This can be done at the same time or taking turns, depending on what works for each family. Information needed to complete the FAFSA includes Social Security number and financial documents, such as those associated with a checking or savings account. I think sitting down doing it together so you can talk about what the questions are asking is actually a really good educational tool for kids to see, because they have to know how much do they have in their savings account. Do they have stocks or anything like that? She said. It's actually a really good conversation starter. ABOR awarded a total of $161,000 to 73 Arizona schools as part of the 50 by Fall campaign this year. According to its announcement of the schools that had met the campaign's FAFSA achievement goals, Arizona has ranked in the top 10 nationally for FAFSA completion improvement during the past five cycles, including ranking sixth in year-over-year improvement for the 2025-2026 cycle. Governor Katie Hobbs has set a 48% FAFSA completion goal for the class of 2026, and according to that announcement, 32.6% of seniors in the state's public high schools have completed the 2026-2027 FAFSA as of January 26th. More information can be found at collegereadyaz.com. The Ask Benji FAFSA support chatbot is at askbenji.org. And that article was FHS recognized for FAFSA completion rates. And as noted previously, that wraps up our front page headline articles for today. Okay, moving on, here's some local news briefs from the Daily Sun staff. The first one is titled, Flagstaff Police Arrest One After Shots Fired. The Flagstaff Police Department arrested a 28-year-old man after he allegedly fired shots inside and outside his apartment on West University Avenue around 2 a.m. Thursday. No injuries were reported from the incident. Patrick Austin Yellowhair was booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility around 3 a.m. on charges of discharging a firearm at a structure, disorderly conduct with a deadly weapon, and discharging a firearm within city limits. Officers reportedly located Yellowhair in a wooded area in the vicinity of the Sterling Point apartment complex. Though still carrying a handgun when police arrived, Yellowhair ultimately surrendered without resistance. The police department did not disclose how many shots Yellowhair fired in total. Fired a gun at a residential structure is a Class 2 felony under Arizona law. Disorderly conduct with a deadly weapon and shooting within city limits are both Class 6 felonies. A preliminary review of Arizona court records showed that Yellowhair pleaded guilty to driving under the influence in Goodyear in 2022, but he appears to have no other criminal history. Anyone with information that may assist the ongoing investigation is encouraged to contact the Flagstaff Police Department at 928-774-1414 or Coconino Silent Witness at 928-774-6111. Here's our next brief titled, Unidentified Remains Task Force Identifies Navajo County Remains. The Coconino County Unidentified Remains Task Force, established last year with participation from the Medical Examiner's Office, Sheriff's Office, Attorney's Office, and other county departments, announced on Tuesday that it had identified a male decedent found in Navajo County in 2023. The task force did not release the name of the individual it identified, citing privacy for his family. The individual's remains have been returned to his family. The case was referred to the task force by the Navajo County Sheriff's Office and Medical Examiner's Office. This is the first successful identification announced since the task force's public launch in July 2025. The group intends to review cases dating back to the 1960s. For decades, some families in the region have lived with unanswered questions about missing loved ones. Advances in forensic science, including DNA sequencing, forensic genealogy, and digital facial reconstruction, now make it possible to revisit these cases with fresh hope, the county's press release stated. Additional information is available at coconino.az.gov/unidentifiedremains. Flag Shakes adds, here's the next brief, sorry. Flag Shakes adds pay what you wish ticket option. Last week, Flag Shakes announced it would be introducing a pay what you wish option for tickets to its main stage productions. The option, referenced as an option to compete with the rising cost of living, will apply to all but a few 2026 productions, as a few collaborations are the exceptions. Shows such as Much Ado About Dinosaurs and Every Brilliant Thing will be included in the pay what you can option. According to Flag Shakes' announcement, the option hopes to lower barriers for low-income and working families, young people being introduced to theater, and artists and audiences who are seeking spaces of connection and reflection. When visitors purchase Flag Shakes tickets online, they will see the standard Flag Shakes ticket prices as well as the zero pay what you wish option. After the number of tickets is selected, an individual donation with the ticket purchase can be made at checkout. Visitors are also welcome to bring a check or cash to the theater. Pay what you wish tickets are not guaranteed to be available at the door and will only be available at the door if the event is not sold out. New season flex passes may be used for special events with higher price points that are not included within the pay what you wish option, such as Shakespeare's Sirens at La Posada and the winter fundraiser Fezziwig's Ball. Season flex passes will also continue to be honored for select weekends or performances where pay what you wish does not apply. For more information, visit flagshakes.org. Next brief, Flagstaff Eagle Scout named Scout of the Year. Scouting Arizona's Grand Canyon Council recently named 8 members as Scouts of the Year, including Nolan Takeuchi of Flagstaff. The 8 members were selected due to their dedication, leadership, heroism, and community service, which have made an impact to their communities, including Casa Grande, Glendale, Mesa, Peoria, Scottsdale, and Sun City. Each of the honorees were nominated by their peers and members of the scouting community. Takeuchi, an Eagle Scout, was inspired to join Scouting Arizona after watching his brothers go through the experience themselves, according to the announcement. Since joining in 2019, Takeuchi has led environmental initiatives such as composting programs and service on the Governor's Youth Commission Conservation and Sustainability Workgroup, as well as volunteering extensively with the Flagstaff Family Food Center. With more than 500 hours of organizing youth volunteer events, Takeuchi earned the President's Volunteer Service Award and the Congressional Gold Award. Takeuchi's Eagle Project created a children's reading room at the food center to benefit countless families. Scouting Arizona's Grand Canyon Council is an independent nonprofit organization chartered by Scouting America. Next brief, Knackered Pepsi, Flagstaff Downtown Business Alliance awarded recycling grants. Projects proposed by Knackered Pepsi and the Flagstaff Downtown Business Alliance were among the 14 awardees of the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, abbreviated as ADEQ, A-D-E-Q, recycling grant awards announced last month. Nearly $1 million was awarded to the 14 projects out of 68 total applicants requesting nearly $8 million, according to the ADEQ. The grants signify an ongoing commitment to supporting the advancement of statewide circular economy efforts and reducing materials sent to Arizona landfills, as explained by the department. Knackered Pepsi was awarded $55,550 in order for it to expand its free recycling program by purchasing 2 cardboard balers and 1 liquid extractor. The equipment will be installed at the company's Prescott and Flagstaff branches to continue increasing the company's recycling operations. The Flagstaff Downtown Business Alliance received $21,471 to install new garbage and recycling bins around Heritage Square, designed to reduce cross-contamination and prevent waste removal. The effort will also include a recycling education campaign through vinyl-wrapped messaging on the bins. Additional awardees for Northern Arizona included Goodwill of Central and Northern Arizona with $72,000 and Slide Rock with $20,489. Goodwill plans to utilize the funds for a 6-month pilot that uses artificial intelligence in 2 ways to build on its textile salvage grading program. Slide Rock will install 10 recycling bins throughout the state park and obtain 4 TerraCycle boxes to dispose of nitrile gloves, with the goal of reducing landfill waste by up to 500,000 pounds annually. ADEQ's recycling grant program is funded through an appropriation in the Environmental Budget Reconciliation Bill for the 2026 fiscal year. And here's the final one in this set of local news briefs. This is Arizona shifts 2026 primary election date up to July 21st. Last week, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs signed a bipartisan bill passed by the Arizona legislature to change the date of the 2026 primary and permanently move Arizona's primaries to the second to last Tuesday in July. Now scheduled for July 21st, 2026, the upcoming primary election was moved to allow elections officials more time to conduct elections preparations for the general election. Included within those preparations is ensuring military and overseas voters have their ballots in time to participate. All qualified voters who live in Coconino County must be registered 29 days before the election to be eligible to cast a ballot for the primary. The new voter registration deadline is June 22nd, with early voting beginning on June 24th. Filing deadlines for candidates running for office were also impacted by the primary's date change, with partisan primary candidates allowed to file between February 21st and March 23rd. The precinct committee write-in deadline is April 6th, and the write-in candidate filing deadline is May 22nd. For more information about the candidate filing period, visit coconino.az.gov/vote. Next up today, we have our letters to the editor. The first one there is headlined, "Time to Put Power Lines Underground." The horrendous power outages caused by the recent storm have put many thousands of people in serious difficulties. The outages are mostly due to power lines being strung on poles above ground because the utility companies have not wanted to spend the money to put the lines underground where they are safe. Profit has come ahead of the safety and well-being of the customers. We tend to think that this country is the best in everything, but this often is not true. For example, in Europe, you seldom see above-ground power lines in urban, suburban, exurban places, and even in the country, excluding, of course, the huge high-voltage lines. In France, for example, nearly 47% of the electrical network is already underground, and the percentage is increasing rapidly. Putting power lines underground is costly, but ever-improving machinery continuously decreases installation time, and further savings are realized by combining installation of power lines with that of fiber optic cables. If Europe can do it, we should be able to do it. Surely it is time for us to catch up and get going with a comprehensive program of burying our lines. Signed, Ivo Lucita, Flagstaff. Next up, permitting reform for clean energy seen as solution. We've read about the rapid growth of data centers supporting artificial intelligence and requiring vast amounts of electricity, which strain electrical grids and increase our bills. We need to add more supply to the grid, and to fight climate change, those sources should be clean energy, primarily solar and wind power. Unfortunately, the permitting process for such projects is slowed by cumbersome requirements, interagency coordination issues, and litigation risks. The vast majority of proposed energy projects will provide clean energy because they're cheaper. In 2025, nearly 90% of newly developed energy projects were solar or wind. We need to build clean energy projects more quickly for our health and to reduce blackouts, make energy more affordable, and help stop climate change. Email your senators and representative in Congress or call them at 202-224-3121 to support common sense permitting reform that protects the public and the environment. Signed, Gary Jump, Volunteer, Citizens Climate Lobby, Flagstaff. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today for news from the Arizona Daily Sun here in Flagstaff. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is your volunteer reader, Joe. Thanks a lot for listening, and stay well, and I will catch you next time, folks. Bye for now.